Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Child, from 1989. Written by Leslie Boehm, John Skip, and Craig Spector, and directed by Stephen Hopkins. Famously, this began as a pitch for Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, with Boehm suggesting that they do a story about a pregnant woman moving into Nancy's old house and dealing with Freddy's attempts to possess her unborn child. This was rejected by producer Sarah Risher, who was either heavily pregnant or had just given birth at the time. I believe the documentary Never Sleep Again suggests the former, while The Movies That Made Us implies the latter. And she didn't want to think about horror involving expectant mothers. But by 1989, Risher's child was getting ready for kindergarten, and it occurred to her that a lot of the 16 to 18-year-olds who had seen the original Nightmare in theaters were in their 20s now and potentially already parents themselves. The 80s were a decade in which the quote-unquote epidemic of teenage pregnancies and single motherhood was just one of many moral panics, and certainly that was a territory the series had explored in a lot of other dimensions to salutary effect. The Russell Sage Foundation has a very good book on the subject, Destinies of the Disadvantaged by Frank Furstenberg, which takes a look at this moral panic in hindsight and finds that it was predictably a load of nonsense that the Republican Party was using to fearmonger its way into political power. That isn't to say there weren't a lot of teen pregnancies in the 80s, because there were, but Furstenberg argues persuasively that there have always been a lot of teen pregnancies, and that historically they didn't result in single motherhood only because teenagers were forced into marriage at a very early age. But the collapse of the industrial and manufacturing base of employment over the course of the 60s, along with the rise of no-fault divorce, led many women to realize that they were better off raising their kids by themselves than being trapped in an abusive marriage, something that public perception was slow to catch up to, and something that the Reagan, Bush, and even Clinton administrations were quick to exploit. Obviously, we're not going to get a scholarly discussion of these topics in this movie, but it's worth pointing out that this was very much on the minds of everyone making and everyone watching it. Even though the pitch originally came from Boehm, Skip and Spector got first crack at the screenplay. That's not too uncommon in Hollywood, where producers buy pitches and then turn them over to other writers on a pretty regular basis. But Skip and Spector's original draft needed a lot of work, and New Line was once again on a very short timetable. After the success of Nightmares 3 and 4, the public was very much in the throes of a Freddy fad, and the studio could not shovel out product fast enough to meet demand. That probably sounds pejorative, but it's really just a fairly basic description of events. Between parts 4 and 5, New Line produced an entire season of Freddy's Nightmares, a TV anthology that served as something of a precursor to HBO's Tales from the Crypt series, with Freddy serving as horror host in the bumpers for each episode. He would also occasionally appear in the stories, as in the premiere episode, which is directed by Toby Hooper and features the events of Krueger's original trial, acquittal, and death. I'd cover all this for the podcast, but the series has never gotten a complete release on DVD and only occasionally pops up on streaming. New Line wanted to get Part 5 out before the public's interest in Freddy cooled, and so they brought in Boehm to do some rewrites on his own concept before hiring Stephen Hopkins, who was at the time a relatively new director, having only done a couple of features before this, to helm the sequel. Hopkins would go on to something of a hot streak in the 90s with Predator 2, Judgment Night, Blown Away, The Ghost in the Darkness, and Lost in Space, before he got deeply into television directing and did several episodes of 24 and House of Lies, among other things. Hopkins definitely had his work cut out for him on this one. According to IMDb, he only had 4 weeks for principal photography, literally half the time Rennie Harlan had for Part 4, and only a further 4 weeks to edit the film together. This was especially difficult in an era where the MPAA was officially gunning for slasher sequels. Having been fairly hands-off in the late 70s and early 80s and gotten nothing but flack for it from parental watchdog groups, they were demanding deeper and deeper cuts to the gory sequences slasher movies thought of as their bread and butter to avoid the dreaded X rating. This kind of censorship in turn led to the introduction of the NC-17 rating the next year to replace X, on the grounds that X was the kiss of death for any general studio release due to its association with pornography. But that was still a year away, and like the Jason movies coming out around this time, a lot of the movie's most impressive special effects wound up on the cutting room floor. Robert Englund, of course, returned to play Freddy, although ironically this was one dream demon who was getting very little sleep due to his heavy workload in this era. The actor had to spend several days getting into full makeup to shoot wraparounds and guest appearances for Freddy's Nightmares on top of this movie, and he was also working on another prosthetics-intensive role around the same time in the remake of The Phantom of the Opera. But he threw himself into all of it with the same energy he always did, and if he was tired, you certainly don't see it on screen. Also returning were Lisa Wilcox as Alice Johnson, Danny Hassel as her boyfriend Dan, and Nicholas Melle as her father Dennis. We've already discussed their careers in the episode on A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, and they certainly didn't have a lot of time to do much work between this movie and that one. I'd be surprised if they even had time to get a haircut before they step back in front of the cameras. That leaves Alice's new gang of friends, which is something of a weakness in this movie, but we'll discuss that in good time. We have Yvonne, played by Kelly Jo Minter, Greta, played by Erica Anderson, and Mark, played by Joe Seeley. Of the three, Minter is probably the most famous in front of the camera. She was working hard throughout the 80s, popping up in supporting roles in films like Lost Boys, Mask, and the cult classic Miracle Mile, as well as in TV shows like T.J. Hooker and Hill Street Blues. She kept working throughout the 90s, appearing in the cult horror films Popcorn and The People Under the Stairs. As Rachel True put it in the documentary Horror Noir, it was an era where a black woman could always find a job in acting as the supportive best friend of the white protagonist, but she's since gone on to a second career as a fashion designer with her own line of handbags. Joe Seeley, on the other hand, only made a handful of appearances in film and television before striking out in his own direction, performing in the LA theater scene alongside masks and puppets he designs and builds himself. He's won awards from the LA Critics Circle for his designs, and one of the delightful little surprises of this podcast is finding out that this person who seems to have had only a very small career when you look at their IMDb page actually has this fascinating and amazing artistic life that you never even knew about. It is very worth your while to go to joeseeley.com and check out his mask gallery, because it's got some really interesting work. Erica Anderson, meanwhile, almost took the opposite tack. She was already appearing on the covers of Vogue as a fashion model before she decided to break into acting, and after this she made appearances in Twin Peaks, Silk Stockings, and Dream On. She hasn't had a huge career in film and television in the last couple of decades, but I believe she's still working steadily in fashion, although it is a little hard to tell because Erica Anderson is such a common name that I could probably find four or five just by going door to door in my local neighborhood. Then again, it's Minnesota. We got a lot of Scandinavian heritage here. That covers the majority of the cast, but there are a few cameos of note. As with the other Elm Street movies, there's a relatively large amount of parental involvement compared to other slasher franchises, usually not for the better, and Dan's grieving parents, ooh, spoilers there, are played by Burr DeBenning and Valerie Armstrong. Both of them were hardworking day players and character actors with long resumes. DeBenning passed away in 2003, Armstrong is still alive but retired from acting, with DeBenning in particular having two roles that tickled my personal fancy. He was Dr. Ted Nelson in the MST3K staple The Incredible Melting Man, and his very final role was an appearance in the music video for The Avalanche's influential hit, Frontier Psychiatrist. And acting in the role of a younger Amanda Krueger, we have Beatrice Beppel, a Canadian actor, those beachcomber appearances never lie, who dropped out of Hollywood and went to India on a spiritual pilgrimage for several years. When she came back to America, she started up her own yoga studio, and that, along with raising a family, kept her busy for a long while. But now that the kids are grown and she has a little more time to herself, she's written a novel that serves as an unofficial prequel to the Elm Street series, and she's also making convention appearances. According to her website, she's trying to get back into horror acting as well, and I wish her all the best. There is one more actor with a memorable role in the movie, but we're about to meet him right at the beginning, so let's just dig right in, okay? We open, after the main titles, with a shot of two people making love over the opening credits. But even though this is Alice and Dan, it's not Lisa Wilcox and Danny Hassel. Both actors had body doubles for this scene, with Wilcox being doubled by Kristen Dante and Sherry Romans at different points in the film. I'm not sure which one of them we're seeing here, though, and an internet search is of very little help. I know I'm not the only person to comment on it, but Google has become less and less useful over the years and more prone to try to redirect you to YouTube videos so it can get more ad revenue. The male double, though, is Michael Bailey Smith, who is hired for a very different part in the movie and pressed into service at the last minute to film these shots, according to his interview in Never Sleep Again. He was actually there to perform as Super Freddy in Mark's Dream Death, a role that started him down a long career of playing thugs, heavies, tough guys, and all-around big burly men. And when I say long, I mean long. His most recent appearance was in 2022, and he has not been out of work for very long during any of that 30-year stretch. He was Ben Grimm in Roger Corman's ill-fated and never properly released Fantastic Four movie. He shows up in the remake of The Hills Have Eyes and in its sequel. He did episodes of Charmed, Babylon 5, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He was the demon who split Xander into his component selves in season 5. And he just generally worked himself into all sorts of TV shows and movies over the years. And it all started here. This is his first role. After they make love, Alice goes to take a shower. There's another body double here, and it's also right around here that you realize they forgot what color the character's hair was in the previous movie. She is a blonde in this film, and it's so distracting. But things turn nightmarish when the drains back up, the water becomes scalding hot, and the door to the shower stall won't open. When Alice finally fights her way free, she finds herself naked in the dank and dismal halls of Weston Hills, now here reimagined as a horrifying amalgamation of all the worst stereotypes of a mental institution combined with Freddy's old boiler room. There are some pretty awful stereotypes of mental illness briefly on display here as the inmates descend onto Amanda Krueger in a scene that thankfully cuts out right away with Alice waking up screaming. But she's sharing her bed with one of the inmates, played sans makeup by Robert Englund, and he briefly assaults her before she wakes up again in one of the double dream fakeouts we've by now become accustomed to. Shaken but not overwhelmed, she gets in the shower and prepares for her big day. And that big day is high school graduation! Alice and Dan celebrate their matriculation alongside their good friends Mark, Greta, and Yvonne, and this illuminates one of the biggest problems with late series installments of slasher movies that I last touched on in Halloween 5. When the supporting cast is whittled down to zero at the end of every movie, it's hard to really recreate that same chemistry for the sequel. In part 4, when we were introduced to Alice and Rick's friend group as a dynamic in progress, it was easy to believe that yes, these were all people who knew each other well and hung out together and had a shared history. But it's been a year, maybe two since part 4, and Alice already has a brand new set of friends that we're supposed to believe that she has the same connection with, even though they didn't get so much as a mention during one of the most stressful events of her entire life. As a result, they feel kind of flat and nondescript, and that's by the standards of the later Freddy movies, where almost everyone once again gets one or two memorable character traits to lead into dream sequences later and function otherwise as interchangeable victims. Speaking of which, Mark is a comics fan, Greta has an eating disorder and an overbearing stage mother, and Yvonne, swims. Not to say that the actors don't do their best with it, but they're dealing with a lot of handicaps here, and it shows. Speaking of Greta's eating disorder, Mark offers her a lick on his oversized novelty lollipop. There's some gross in hindsight dialogue about how he's quote-unquote wearing her down with his constant come-ons, but this wasn't an era where that was seen as problematic like it should have been. When her mom calls out from across the crowd, "Greta, that's not what a cover girl puts in her body." Greta's mother is played by Pat Sturges, who, like Brooke Bundy in parts 3 and 4, knows she's there to inject the little campy mommy dearest energy into the production, and her over-the-top performance really takes what should be an awful portrait of emotional abuse and puts it into the realm of absurdity so you can safely enjoy it. A bit like Robert Englund's Freddy, in fact. The group plans a pool party post-graduation, because even though she's no longer in high school, Yvonne somehow still has swimming practice? And you can tell that this whole sequence got chopped up and remixed in the editing room, because Alice is very clearly holding airplane tickets that she's presented with just two shots later. Dan's proud father is angling to get him a football scholarship, which distracts him from hearing about Alice's recent and troubling spate of familiar-feeling nightmares, and Alice's dad seems to have pulled a no-show. But it turns out he was just watching from the very back, still a little worried that his kid is ashamed of him, even though he's quit drinking and is going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really like this low-key background character arc for Dennis Johnson. He's taken the death of his son as a sign that he needs to pull out of his self-destructive spiral and take care of his daughter, and he's turning his life around. It's honestly sweet, and it's one of the few bits of growth and development we see out of anyone in this franchise. Good for him. Alice goes to work, hoping to get in a shift before the party, but as she cuts through the park to get to the Crave Inn, she sees a group of kids skipping rope to the good old Freddy song. I could be wrong, but this may be its last appearance in the franchise. She follows them into the woods, and this time the last verse of the song changes to 9:10, he's back again, in a moment that feels like it was written especially for the trailer. The woods give way to a massive gothic building that's intended to be Weston Hills again, even though it doesn't look anything like the real thing we saw in part 3. It is a dream, though. More on that later. And Alice both witnesses and experiences Amanda Krueger's painful labor as she gives birth to Freddy Krueger. Apparently, Beppel was on her menstrual cycle while filming this scene, which made it even more uncomfortable and awkward. The infant, which looks disturbingly like Gollum with Freddy Krueger's face, wriggles out of the attending nurse's hands and skitters out into the hallway, and when Alice gives chase, she finds herself back in the church from the climax of part 4. The baby crawls into Freddy's discarded outfit and grows back into adulthood in mere moments, with Freddy heralding his return by announcing, "It's a boy!" Which also feels like it was shot just for the trailer. It's honestly a pretty impressive sequence, even if it does return to the whole Amanda Krueger plotline that I'm not exactly thrilled with. Freddy begins to menace Alice, but he flees when Amanda shows up saying that her son's birth was an abomination against God and she won't allow it to happen a second time. She tells Alice to look for her in a tower, and that's a very obvious third act plot hook that everyone's just going to ignore for a while because the movie would be pretty short otherwise, and Alice wakes up back at the diner with 4 hours of missing time. Her coworker Anne is understandably annoyed with her, but she's more concerned about the return of her arch nemesis, the Revenant serial killer. She calls Dan to warn him, and he tells her he's on his way. But this ain't the Scream franchise, and we're not taking two protagonists all the way through the sequel. Dan nods off while driving, and Freddy takes control of the car, sending him straight into oncoming traffic. Incidentally, Kevin Yeager is off this movie, and Howard Berger is now doing the Freddy makeup, and you can really see in this scene that they kind of aged the character up a little to make him feel a little more fatherly for this installment. Dan dreams that he's flung from the car and finds himself back in the school, now empty, but when he tries to take his motorcycle to meet Alice instead, it grows into his body and fuses him with the machine, turning him into a cyborg in an amazing effect sequence that was unfortunately hacked into pieces by the MPAA. You can find the uncut version on YouTube pretty easily, though. Dan is killed in the subsequent collision, and back at the diner, Alice experiences a vision of him getting sucked down what appears to be an umbilical cord. She races outside, finding her boyfriend dead only a block or two away, and faints from shock. When she wakes up in the hospital, Yvonne, who's a candy striper there, informs her that Dan's dead, and she's pregnant. And wow, this movie really gets a lot of things right about being a woman in the medical system for a screenplay that was written by 3 men. The second the doctor finds out she's pregnant, he immediately puts Alice's claims that Dan was murdered and didn't have any alcohol in his bloodstream down to unspecified hysteria, even though it's something that would be easy to check, and even though Dan is one of only 2 survivors of a bizarre string of improbable and impossible accidents that have occurred regularly over the last couple of years in Springwood. The moment Alice has a fetus in her uterus, her body no longer belongs to her, and that's honestly the most accurate and terrifying thing about this installment, and it only hits harder 35 years after its initial release. Alice stays overnight for observation, and while she rests, she's visited in her room by a little boy named Jacob, who's looking for someone to keep him company. This is, of course, a dream, although it's one of the more subtle ones. And not to spoil, but Jacob is actually her unborn child communicating with her telepathically through the shared dreamscape. And I know I gave a lot of shit to Evil Dead Rise for suggesting that unborn babies have souls, and I know that this movie goes several steps further by suggesting they also have minds and personalities and the ability to understand what schools are as well as why they would be out for one Freddy Krueger in particular, but I don't feel like it hits the same way here because Alice is never conflicted about wanting her baby. This isn't pro-life propaganda inflicted on a character who wants an abortion. It's just more of the somewhat inconsistent dream logic of a franchise that's already full of it, and I feel like this film already comes down very hard on the pro-choice side of the equation, even though it's about a mother who's not interested in having an abortion, because she's still having her bodily autonomy taken away from her, and the movie makes it clear how bad that is. We'll get into it more later, I promise. The next day, Alice fills in her surviving friends on the Freddy Krueger lore in an exposition dump we've all come to know very well. Her friends don't believe her, despite going to a high school that's had a body count in the high teens over the last 6 to 8 years, but Greta tries to reassure her that if anything's coming for Alice, it's going to have to go through her friends first. Can't say that's foreshadowing or anything. Later, Alice and her dad have a little heart-to-heart about her pregnancy, and he really shows his character growth by handling the news in a respectful, loving, and non-judgmental way. He buys healthy food, he tells her that he's looking forward to hearing a little boy playing around the house again, which is a genuinely moving and affecting line given what happened to Rick in the previous installment, and I never thought I'd be saying that about Part 5 in the Freddy series, and you can just tell that he knows this is a wanted child even if it was an unplanned pregnancy. Seriously, this guy is so good in this movie, both as a character and an actor. But because this is a Freddy sequel and we can't go on too long without another inventive dream death, Greta nods off at one of her mother's interminable dinner parties, and honestly, the real horror comes from the way she dismisses Dan as nobody special, in order to make it clear to her very important guests that Greta doesn't have any scandals lurking in her closet, and Freddy shows up as the waiter and traps her in a high chair before force-feeding Greta her own intestines until she chokes to death on them, in yet another scene that was hacked almost to nothing by the MPAA. This is definitely not one of my favorite installments for a variety of reasons, but I feel like it would have improved at least a little if the censors hadn't trimmed out so much from the visually striking centerpieces that they're almost incoherent as a result. You don't even know what's happening to Greta unless you've already been told. By the way, I actually own an action figure of Freddy in the waiter's costume in this scene. It was a gift from my girlfriend, and I'm very glad she doesn't listen to this podcast. Horror movies aren't her thing, because she won't know how I feel about the movie she gifted me a very lovely toy from. Alice once again experiences the murder, this time in the form of seeing all the food in her refrigerator rotting away to nothing before Greta reaches out a hand desperately for her shortly before being sucked into the fridge, which has its door close rapidly. The vision vanishes, but she already knows Freddy's claimed another victim. She and Yvonne go to visit Mark at his father's warehouse, his dad is played by Clarence Felder, and of course Mark's broken up about losing his crush. Alice tries to explain just how bizarre the deaths are, even by the somewhat loose rules of this franchise. Freddy's only access to the shared dreamscape should be through Alice, and she's been keeping him imprisoned and powerless since the end of Part 4, but it all just sounds like so much gibberish to Yvonne. Mark is starting to believe it, though, and he wants to find out what led to Greta's death and who killed her. Yvonne goes off to her shift at the hospital, while Mark and Alice hang out in a little den he made at the back of the warehouse decorated with his drawings of his own original superhero, the Phantom Prowler, where a TV plays what I can only assume to be some kind of bizarre inside joke. It's a clip from an old show called The Hot Seat, where conservative commentator Wally George interviewed various people in a combative style that Rush Limbaugh and Alex Jones would later hone into a fine art, and his guests are Ted Nugent, Ron Armstrong, Rudy Sarzo, and Eric Singer. But as near as I can tell, these men were never in a band together, and we don't linger on the television long enough to get the context of any of it, so it's just, oh hey, is that Ted Nugent? I mainly mention it because if anyone had Ted Nugent in the pool of actors I'd never cover on this podcast, you technically lost. Mark falls asleep while Alice is making coffee, though, and winds up in the familiar house on Elm Street that you really have to hope Nancy's ghost is charging psychic rent on. Alice dreams herself into it using his drawings as a focus, which is actually pretty cool, and she just barely saves him from being sucked down the same umbilical cord that claimed Dan. Mark faints at the sight of his own blood, though, and winds up waking up, which feels like one of those things that needs much closer examination than it gets, leaving Alice alone in the house. Only, of course, she isn't, because Jacob is there, dressed like one of the inmates from the asylum dream at the beginning. He's looking a little the worse for wear, though, haggard and drawn, and he says that his other friend has been telling him that his mommy doesn't want him. Alice realizes who he must be and tries to deny it, but Jacob is pulled away by Freddy and Alice wakes up. She helps Mark bandage his hands, and then goes to the doctor to get a checkup on the physical state of her unborn child, while Mark goes to get some research done. During the ultrasound, the condescending Dr. Moore, played by Stephen Grimes, tells Alice that her fetus spends up to 70% of the time in a dream state, which wouldn't even be remotely true at this stage in the gestation. She's probably still in her first trimester, and the fetus is really just a cluster of cells. But again, late-stage Freddy movies play fast and loose with their own logic most of the time. And she has a dream of Freddy in the womb feeding the souls of her dead friends to Jacob to corrupt him into a dream demon of his own. Alice is clearly distraught when she wakes, and in a perfect example of why we needed HIPAA laws so badly, the doctor calls Dan's parents up to tell them that the mother of their grandkids is acting erratic. Alice, to her credit, realizes how all this sounds to someone who wasn't involved in the events of the previous movie, but she prevails upon Yvonne to have a little bit of faith in her despite the wildness of her story. But Yvonne is reacting like this is the real world and not a horror movie, even as Mark comes in with 4 movies worth of newspaper headlines to back up what Alice is saying. She storms out, and Mark gets ready to leave when Dan's parents show up to ask Alice what she intends to do with the baby. But not before asking if she's thought about having an abortion to cut off Kruger's access to the dreamscape, an awkward but important question that's handled with surprising taste for a movie where someone gets force-fed their own intestines. Mr. and Mrs. Jordan do that instant villain signifier thing by offering to pay Alice off to have the baby and give it up to them for adoption, using her outburst at the doctor's office as blackmail against her to suggest that if she doesn't give the baby up, they'll have her committed and take the baby away. Which, again, is another way of showing how Alice loses her bodily autonomy the second she becomes an incubator for the fetus. This is actually touching on a number of issues involving women and bodily autonomy and independence. We've seen this happen with Britney Spears, where a woman can simply have her independence taken away for years, if not decades, simply by getting a court order saying that she's not competent to handle her own affairs. And this combines a lot of those tropes together in a single scene that's very powerful and very effective. Dennis, to his credit, tells them to fuck off and kicks them right the fuck out of his house, because he's secretly the goddamn hero of this movie and you can't tell me otherwise, but there's very clearly an implied threat that Alice is no longer in control of her body, even though she wants her child, and that is a very pro-choice message to me. Also, Alice's outfit in this scene is a painful reminder that nothing is more horrible than that weird crossfade moment in cultural history when the fashion trends of one era become the fashion trends of another, and both she and Mark are wearing garish and baggy patterned outfits that somehow combine the worst looks of the 80s with a glimpse of the most hideous styles of a decade yet to come. Maybe that's some of why this movie is so hated. It's just viscerally unpleasant to look at the character. Mark and Alice go through his research, leading to what I think could be the dumbest retcon not just of this series, but the entire history of the genre itself. Honestly, I'd say it was the dumbest retcon ever, but I read that issue of Alpha Flight where Guardian explained that he was teleported to one of the moons of Jupiter and turned into a cyborg instead of being killed in an explosion. My favorite part about that? Originally, it was meant to be a parody of implausible superhero resurrections, with an impersonator showing up with an obviously nonsensical story knowing that the more bizarre the bullshit, the more likely comics fans were to believe it. Then a new writer came along and revealed that no, it was all true, and the impersonator just learned it from the real guy who was being held captive. Anyway. Yes, what we learn is that Amanda Kruger's grave that we saw in part 3 is empty, and that although we all thought she hanged herself after Kruger's trial, unable to live with the thought of her own son being responsible for the murder of all those children, they never actually found the body. Which, one, they didn't have to implant the false rumor about her death being a suicide, that's not in the previous installments, and two, the thing about hanging yourself is, not to be tactless, if you do it, one thing you're gonna be pretty damn sure of is that they're going to find your body. It's literally tied to the instrument of death. I just cannot get over how stupid this is when you think about it for even 5 seconds. Some cop finding an overturned stool in an empty noose and saying, "I'm sure she'll turn up somewhere. It's just a matter of time." Also, Mark says that her soul is in torment, and when Alice asks how he knows, he holds up a book labeled Christian Mythology and says, "It's in here. Somewhere." Like what, were Bibles so expensive in 89 that you had to go off-brand? I know, in actual fact, this was probably done to prevent protests about the Bible appearing in such a blasphemous franchise, but it looks silly, and frankly, you'd think they'd be pretty eager to show evangelical protesters that God is stronger than Freddy Krueger in the end. Alice finally remembers that, oh yeah, Amanda Krueger did mention something about her soul being trapped in a tower somewhere and needing to be freed to stop Freddy once and for all, but her solution is to go into her dreams and ask Amanda where it is instead of going to Weston Hills where Amanda was institutionalized for life and where there's a big abandoned tower? While she sleeps, both Yvonne and Mark begin to nod off in their respective locations, with Yvonne dreaming about the diving board she climbs onto becoming impossibly tall and clawed like Freddy's glove, forcing her to plummet into a pool that suddenly drains down into a single impossibly deep puddle. Alice goes into Yvonne's dream to save her, impaling Freddy through the mouth with a pool skimmer, but Dan's not so lucky. He gets pulled into one of his own comics, reverse aha style, and finds himself in a black and white version of the warehouse with Freddy stalking him. If you really want to know about the aha reference, go back and listen to the Ash vs. Evil Dead Season 3 Part 1 episode. I went into it pretty heavily there. Now, I'll admit, this particular dream death really kind of encapsulates everything I don't like about the dream powers phase of the series. Freddy is so campy that it's impossible to be frightened by the sequence. He's skateboarding around on a board with claws at the front. And although the Phantom Prowler persona that Mark transforms himself into to fight Freddy looks cool as all hell, we already know that it's not going to work because nothing anyone ever does to fight Freddy before the last 5 minutes of the movie works, so it's just window dressing for another death. And when Freddy turns into quote-unquote Super Freddy, played again by Michael Bailey Smith in one of the very few times someone else dons the makeup in the franchise's history, I just don't get what emotion they're going for. He's not scary. He's not funny. It's just, yep, that's a dad joke made by your old man who only remembers about 3 comic book characters, but still wants to show you how cool he is. It's visually interesting, especially when Freddy slashes Mark and he becomes a pen and ink drawing of himself with the color running out of him like blood, but emotionally, it's a nothing. I should feel something for Mark's death, and I don't. And I have to say, that feels like all the flaws of the dream trilogy of nightmare movies in a nutshell. Yvonne and Alice wake up, and Alice finds Mark dead under a collapsed pile of shelving in what looks like an industrial accident. Yvonne races to the warehouse, and Alice asks her to go to Weston Hills and find Amanda's remains. She's then taken off by her dad to go home and get some rest, because nobody's perfect, and Yvonne heads off to an abandoned and crumbling gothic mansion that I guess is supposed to be where Amanda spent her days after Freddy was born? Like, I'm not sure whether they were trying to imply that the ruined wing of Weston Hills where we saw Amanda in the previous movie isn't actually her final resting place, even though that's the only emotional through line between the two ghost appearances, and they just didn't convey the information very well, or if this is the same place and Hopkins just wanted to make it a spooky gothic mansion so badly that continuity went out the window. But let's face it, that's not the first time this has happened in this franchise, so I guess we just have to go with it. Alice goes to sleep to confront Freddy in the dreamscape, and Yvonne goes looking for the body, and there is kind of a neat parallel to the way they're both traveling through the same spaces that I wish they could have made more of. Alice shouts out a quick recap of the plot for the benefit of people who weren't paying attention, explaining to Freddy that Freddy is using Jacob's perpetually dreaming mind for his own benefit and trying to remake the child in his image, and she's not going to let it happen, while Yvonne breaks into a brick wall that's been sealed up Amontillado style. Freddy and Alice fight, and I gotta say, I like the way Alice is really just going for it here. Impaling Freddy with a spiked baby carriage and sending him rolling into a room where the inmates of the Dream Asylum tear him apart. I don't think Lisa Wilcox gets enough credit for the grit and determination she brings to this character, mainly because the two installments she's in are some of the least well-received. But I'd be happy to see her reprise this role anytime. Freddy recovers, Alice finds Jacob, and Freddy, Alice, and Jacob all wind up in an M.C. Escher maze because this was the 1980s and everyone was wild for M.C. Escher. They then reprise Labyrinth for a few minutes in a goofy Scooby-Doo-style chase where Freddy momentarily takes Dan's form to try to trick Jacob into letting him get close, even though Jacob really shouldn't know what anyone looks like. But Freddy vanishes, and Jacob explains that Freddy is hiding inside Alice because he knows her so well that he can always lurk in her dreams, unseen and unsuspected. That makes no sense at all, and doesn't fit in with anything else we've seen in the movie or the franchise, but much like the dream powers in Part 3 and the mirror in Part 4, it's said with conviction by an actor who sounds like they're talking about something we've already been told, and that's good enough for the moment. Alice realizes that she needs to force Freddy out of her body, pushing him out in an effect sequence that's very cool and very gross, and features an Evil Dead 2-inspired Deadite scream. Yvonne finds Amanda's body, posed in a kneeling position in a bricked-up room and presumably placed there by Freddy, even though it's never explicitly stated. I think we're meant to assume that she never died by suicide at all. Freddy killed her after he was acquitted, he hid her body, and she's been unable to rest knowing that his demonic dream self was out there killing people. It's certainly the only way any of the stuff about a hidden corpse makes sense, although again, this isn't a franchise that's big on real-world logic. Freed from her limbo, Amanda enters the dream and helps Jacob purge the souls Freddy fed him as an attack. The line that was used, "School's out, Krueger," was a substitute when they found out that the juvenile actor wasn't allowed to say, "Fuck you, Krueger." Neither of which a fetus should know. The souls drag Freddy over to Amanda, who imprisons him within her and relieves Alice of the burden of containing Freddy, and she wakes up saddened by the knowledge that Amanda is doomed to eternal struggle with her own evil, twisted child, but grateful that Jacob will have a loving childhood, free of Freddy's curse. We skip ahead to after the baby is born, and she, Yvonne, and Dennis all settle into a loving bout of co-parenting in the park. But we see a suspiciously familiar group of jump-roping kids, and we know there's never a real end to this story. The credits play to Let's Go by Kool Moe Dee, which is not written for this movie and is actually a diss track aimed at LL Cool J. But there was a song written for this movie, Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, written by Iron Maiden's lead singer Bruce Dickinson and later recorded as part of the Iron Maiden album No Prayer for the Dying. It did not get an official video with Robert Englund playing Freddy Krueger, though, which may be the first sign of the character's cultural decline. The second sign was this movie's box office, which was less than half of what Part 4 made, and which got New Line thinking that, as with Friday the 13th, maybe the best way to get people back into the theaters would be to promise one last hurrah for a beloved franchise. But that's for a couple of episodes from now. At the moment, the question is, will I hang on to this movie? And the answer, again with the caveat that this is all hypothetical because what I've got is an 8-disc set of the first 7 movies and Freddy vs. Jason, and I'm not going to break it up, is no. If this was a standalone movie, I would sell it back. I liked it more on this viewing, with some real appreciation for Elisa Wilcox and Kelly Jo Minter and a few of the quieter, emotional moments, but The Dream Child just feels like the franchise is running on fumes. There's fewer deaths and what feels like lower production values, even though this one actually cost more than Part 4, but we don't sacrifice imaginative dream sequences for richer character development. Instead, we get a lot of nonsensical exploration of the lore, specifically of the exact part of the lore I don't like and want to sweep under the rug, and a movie that barely crosses the finish line where the previous installment at least sprinted with gusto. I try not to rank films anymore, but it's safe to say that this one isn't a favorite of the franchise. And if you want to talk about Super Freddy, that one issue of Alpha Flight, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, it is Christmas Eve as I record this, and I just know that I probably got a few DVDs waiting for me under the tree that are going to change all of my plans for the upcoming slate of episodes. But for now, I don't know what they are, and my rule is always to make my call on the next installment by the time I go to record so I can put this bumper in live. So we'll leave the post-holiday haul for another day, literally tomorrow in fact, and cover a 1983 Italian zombie flick I've been interested in finding for literal decades. I finally nabbed a copy under its American title, Revenge of the Dead, but I first learned about it from Jamie Russell's comprehensive history of the zombie movie Book of the Dead under its original title, Zader. And I can't wait to see it and share it with all of you at long last. See you then.